of that, hopefully. And he's going to talk to us about the future of work. In a time when technology seems to be taking over everything, how will our future jobs look like? And what will we do? We've already had a taste of that with Mike sort of telling us about the jobs of the future. Steve's going to add to that and maybe change that vision a little bit. So over to Steve.
Okay, well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. And it's very interesting to see such a wide range of people from all over the world here. And so I'm going to address you in what I regard as a kind of serious way. Namely, I take it the people in this room are the future leaders of various countries around the world. And so you ought to be taken seriously in that vein. So I'm going to talk to you about the future. I've been asked to talk about the future of work, as has been mentioned already. This is not my natural topic, but it's quite relevant to what my natural topic is, and that's the future of humanity. Okay? I've been very much working on something called Humanity 2.0. And I've got several books on this topic, and you can look them up if you're interested. And what is the connection between work and humanity? You might ask that question. And the way I want to begin this is by talking about something that some of you, if you've studied economics or maybe if you've studied intellectual history or sociology, you may know about, and that's the idea of the labor theory of value. How many of you have heard of this idea, the labor theory of value? A few of you, actually a fair number have. Okay, so I guess this theory is normally associated with Karl Marx. Maybe that's the way you've run across it. In fact, this is quite an old idea. This is an idea that goes back into medieval Christianity. And the idea is that the value of any kind of thing that's produced comes primarily from human labor. And the emphasis is on the human. Okay? And this is quite an important point, and it helps to explain the way in which somebody like Marx was seen as a kind of critic of capitalism in the 19th century. Because there's a sense in which there's a kind of conception of what a human being is that's built into the idea of the labor theory of value. And that is, the human being is in some sense potentially infinite in his or her productivity. Human beings are creative beings. And in a way, creative beings in a way in which no other animal is creative. And this is because, and again, this is why I mentioned Christianity in the beginning, because it does come from the Christianity, we're creating the image and likeness of God. So this business about labor is kind of the human equivalent of God's creative power, only it's applied to humans in a kind of small way. But humans are infinitely creative. And so the problem with social relations, at least according to Karl Marx, was that people were actually being held back from being as productive as possible, right? And why were they being held back? Well, because for reasons of class and race and all these other things, and as a result, people could not get ahead. They were not able to use their labor to the fullest possible extent, okay? That's been, you know, that's the kind of, you might say, the original kind of way in which human beings were being held back from being fully human, right? That's where the labor theory of value is very closely connected to our notion of humanity. Now, the thing, of course, with capitalism is technology starts to enter into the picture, right? And we start talking about the replacement of human labor with technology. So the question is no longer, are people being held back from being productive? But rather, are there other things that can be productive more efficiently than humans? Right? So in other words, capitalism, in a very direct kind of way, through the introduction of technology and automation, challenges us to justify the value of being human in a way in which no other political economy had done before. Okay? And so to put it in contemporary terms, and those of you who study economics will know about this, is what is the value added of being human? Why do we need humans from the standpoint of producing wealth? Okay? And it seems to me that this question is going to be increasingly on the table in the future. Now, of course, already in the 19th century and throughout the 20th century, automation was replacing human labor, you know, in the sort of areas where human muscle capacity and physical endurance and things like that in factory work, things of that kind, right? Human beings were being replaced already at that time, and that was the kind of, you know, you might call technologically driven unemployment that somebody like Karl Marx and the Marxists were very concerned about. But as we move into the second half of the 20th century, with the rise of the computer revolution, okay, we now get into a new mode of replacement of human labor, and that is the replacement of intellectual labor. Okay, and this is something that you might say the computer revolution is all about. So in other words, it's not simply that we're replacing, you might say, the purely animal qualities of human beings, right? The ones that involve physical, you know, brute energy force. That was a very 19th century way of thinking about labor, okay? But in the late 20th century and into our own time, we're seeing actually intellectual labor being replaced by computers, okay? How does this happen? Well, basically, one of the things that's taken place through the introduction of capitalism, through the way in which our societies have become more complex, is that the mental cognitive tasks that people need to perform in order to survive have become more specialized. Right? The division of labor, as it's often called in the history of capitalism, right, has gone into the brain. Right? And so people specialize. They become doctors, they become lawyers. If they become academics, they become academics who only know about a very specialized area. Now you see, the more specialized your intellectual labor becomes, the more routinized it becomes, and the easier it becomes to be replaced by a computer. Okay? So this is the interesting thing about specialization, right? We see specialization as a kind of response to the increasing complexity of society, right? And we see that as a mark of an advanced and civilized and sophisticated society that has all these specialists and all this complexity. But at the same time, each one of those specialists becomes easier and easier to replace, right? Because the particular function that they are serving is narrower and narrower, and in a sense, in a more restricted environment. Right? The reason why you go to a specialist or a professional is because they know about a narrow, well-defined area very well. And you don't know it. You're outside of that. Well, if that's the kind of knowledge you're talking about, that's exactly what a computer can do. Okay? And so this is why we're imagining, I mean, this is what, you know, not just people in artificial intelligence research, but also people in the medical profession, people in the legal profession, other kinds of profession where the vast majority of cases that the professionals deal with are routinized, right? They're imagining computers will replace them, right? So, you know, those of you who are studying for a law degree, get your degree as soon as possible because there aren't going to be so many lawyers needed in the next generation. Trust me, most lawyers do routine work that a computer can do. And moreover, I mean, and if you think about how much time and how much money it costs to get a law degree, from a future standpoint, it's a complete waste of time. Because the computer is going to replace you within 10 years. You'll be lucky, you know, so make all your money early. That's all I have to tell you. And then move out of that field. For most ordinary lawyers, trust me. Look, already people are able to get computer programs to, you know, for divorces, for wills. They don't need lawyers. The only time you need a lawyer is when people get into a major disagreement. And then the lawyer, you know, has to kind of figure something out. Okay? It's interesting the way you're responding. I wasn't expecting this kind of very lively, vivid response, but clearly I see where you people are going. Okay? But if you're thinking about the future, okay, that the kind of labor that is going to be valued in the future is going to be the creative labor, right? The labor that actually escapes the routine. Okay? And so that's why there will always be a place for lawyers who have to deal with trials where there are, you know, irreconcilable differences and there's a lot of complication that cannot be reduced to a simple routine. There will always be jobs for those people because those are the creative lawyers, right? There'll always be jobs for those people. But what there won't be jobs for are the routine lawyers, the people who want a quiet, rich life, right? All that mediocrity that makes a lot of money, they'll be gone. Now, maybe you're aspiring to that and that's why you're laughing. But the point is, you should think about your future in these terms, right? That there's a sense in which what automated technology is likely to do in the future is to replace the whole middle range of professional life. There will, so we, you know, because one of the things that was very striking, if you look at the history of social mobility, especially in the West over the last 200 years, there is this tendency, and it's a tendency, in fact, in my family as well, for people who, let's say, whose parents or grandparents were from working class backgrounds, okay, and then, you know, the children get a university education and they become professionals, and so what you're, and in this scenario, what you're imagining is that the machines will replace all that working class work, right? So the blue collar aspect of labor will disappear over time, and almost everybody will be a so-called white collar laborer, right? Someone who works at a desk job or works with, you know, paper and words and things like that. That was the way in which it was talked about in the second half of the 20th century when I was your age. That's bullshit, right? You guys will get replaced too. This is my point. You guys will be replaced too. And so the question will come about what is the value added of being human? Okay, that's the question that needs to be put on the table. Okay, because one of the things that if you want to look at the history of technology and you take kind of a long view of it, right, from, you know, when our brains kind of reached the current form they have 40,000 years ago, right, to the way we are now, so from the beginning of writing, let's say, to now, what you would say is that technology, generally speaking, starts in a way what the human is what ends up escaping the technology. Okay? So for example, you know, if you went to the late 19th century and you had people talk about what it is to be a good scientist, okay, scientists, or, right, you would get a lot of discussion about the ability to observe things. To observe things, observe planets, observe birds, right? Depending on your physics or natural history, whatever your science is, that would have been the thing. That was a very human, that was seen as a very sophisticated, nuanced thing. In fact, now we have got technology doing most of the observational work in the sciences. So what it means to be scientific now, if we're talking about a human being scientific, has to be something other than observational. It has to somehow have to do with the creative process of the theorizing, right? But then, of course, we have artificial intelligence machines that are being designed to try to reproduce that, right? So as it were, the boundary of where the human begins and the machine ends is constantly shifting. And the way I've talked about this in some of my work is that to be human, humanity is a fugitive essence, right? It's always running away from something. What it is to be human is to be running away, to be able to escape from what technology can control. Which is to say, there's nothing constant about being human. Okay? It is always shifting because it's being defined in relation to these technologies. Now, this poses all kinds of issues, okay? Because one of the things that you might know, I mean, maybe you do or you not don't know, is that there is now also this movement afront. Universal basic income. How many of you have heard of this? Now, you think about this. How does this relate to what I've just said? I don't think it relates very well. Okay? Because you've got to ask the question, right? What exactly are human beings going to do with this basic income? Okay? What are we talking about here exactly? Okay? So the idea here, you know, I want to say a little bit about this because I realize this is kind of a popular topic now. It's certainly popular in the circles I'm in. But I'd like you to take a look at this concept from a perspective that says, look, you cannot look at this in isolation. You have to look at this in terms of a larger question about what sort of being are we going to be in the future, okay? Because people who advocate universal basic income basically seem to think that, we're going to be in this world where technology will be able to replace human labor, human beings won't need to work, and in fact, all of these machines will be doing everything for us, and that's granted. And so, human beings shouldn't have to work. Human beings should just be, paid to live. Paid to live, basically. Isn't that what it boils down to, right? Paid to live. Okay? And so the question is, one might want to ask a question. Under those circumstances, what is the point of that? Now, the reason why I ask this question, is not that I'm in fact a very pro-human person. But one of the things that I would say is that the labor theory of value actually has been incredibly central to the way in which people like Marx and others concerned about the welfare of humanity have defined what a human being is. So that when you remove work from the equation, when work is no longer necessary to be a human, then what are we talking about it means to be human? Is to be human a kind of perceptive vegetable? I mean, what are we talking about? So in other words, forget for the moment whether universal basic income could be funded. Let's assume it could be funded. The question is, what kind of a being would be on the other end of this? And would this being count as human? Okay? And I think this is a really, really important question. And those of you who know some of the political history in the way it's been played out in recent times, know that whenever this idea is put forward, for the most part, has been rejected. Even in countries which can afford to do it. Okay? Switzerland last year comes to mind as a place where this was actually on a national referendum and it was voted down. And you have to think, why do people vote? Now, people tend to interpret this as saying, it's going to be difficult to tax the big IT companies and all the rest of it. But what I'm asking you to think about is supposing we could tax them, supposing we could actually raise the income to provide a kind of universal coverage as is suggested here, okay? What would these people do? Moreover, okay, the interesting thing about this is also we've got another issue on the table which is related a lot to the issue of increasing automation in technology, and that is the increasing improvement in medicine in terms of the human condition. To put it bluntly, we are living longer and longer, and we're living, and in principle at least, living healthier lives, or at least better health care is made increasingly available to more people. So what we're talking about here, if we take the universal basic income idea seriously, in a world without work, where people are living longer, is we're basically trying to create some kind of universal vegetative state. That's kind of what it looks like. Okay? And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because when people talk about the future of work, when people talk about universal basic income, when people talk about the fact that medical science is improving and our life expectancies are increasing and all that, they tend to be talking about them in different rooms, having different arguments, different discussions. These things rarely get put in the same basket, but they are all being promoted at the same time, right? So in other words, we could live in a world where all these things happen at once. And the question is, what would the world look like under those circumstances? Okay, what kind of a world are we talking about? Now, let me tell you something, just to give you a sense of the universal basic income idea wasn't just invented now. It was in fact present in the 1970s and 1980s. In fact, I taught about it when it was first initially proposed, and it had a very different kind of spin to it, okay? The idea was to grant that technology was going to replace
most jobs, and so people would have more time available to them. But the idea behind universal basic income was that once people do not have to work for a living, they would do sort of what Marx was suggesting in the Communist Manifesto. They would get more involved in public life. They would be in politics, basically. You'd have the time to actually think about what do you want to do with all this wealth that all these machines are creating. So you would have a much more lively civil society. This was the original idea. I mean, if you want to read the man who put this out in the late 70s, early 80s, is a French intellectual by the name of André Gorz, Critique of Economic Reasoning. You can look his work up. He was the guy who was the big deal, first big deal on this, and it was in the context of a kind of quasi-Marxist scenario, okay, where people would actually get more involved in public life. Okay, Gorz was not imagining the following. Gorz did not imagine that people would end up living as long as they seemed to be living and people want to live. And also he wasn't imagining the way in which the computer revolution would end up, you might say, rearranging the way we think about ourselves. So in other words, with the increase in our computer automation, right, it's had an effect not only in our work habits, but also in our personal habits. Right? He didn't anticipate that side of the story. He sort of thought that the human being who would be left on the other side of automation would kind of be like the usual human being, some kind of essential human being. But in fact, human beings, their brains, their attitudes, what they do, is also being radically transformed by this computer revolution. So they may not be working any longer, they may not have to work as hard as they used to, but that's not where the influence stops. The influence of the computer goes into your head. Okay? And so as a result, people aren't so interested in politics. This is the point, right? People with a lot of time in their hands aren't necessarily interested in politics. They're interested in video games. They're interested in consuming and buying stuff, right? The kind of politics they tend to think about is very episodic and expressive. In other words, you know, you have a protest. You use your smartphone, you sort of crowdsource a protest for about 2 days, then it disappears and things are back to normal again. And this even happens in cases where there's a serious attempt being made to change the political system, as in the Arab Spring from about 7 years ago now. Right? So in other words, the kind of world that Gorz was imagining would be on the other side of universal basic income was one that presupposed that all that the computer automation did was to remove the drudgery of work, but he wasn't imagining that it would also change the way people think about themselves, each other, and the world. He wasn't imagining that. And so that kind of influence on who we are and how we think about ourselves has been incredibly profound. And that changes the whole ball game with regard to the way in which we should think about universal basic income. Okay? Now, I don't want to go too much further because I realize we're already running a little late, and I want to get a couple of questions from the audience, and we'll have maybe more time to talk about it in the panel. But I do think that there is a question here. You know, it goes to this original question: what is the value added of being human? What difference does it make? Okay? And the context in which I want you to think about this now is in the context of a world in which we are also claiming, right, we're also claiming that human beings are the major source of climate change, right? There are too many human beings around, they're doing too much shit to the environment, they're corrupting everything, and as a result, within 50 years, right, we may be in some kind of catastrophic situation, right? This is also on the table. And the point is, who is to blame? The humans. The humans, right? The humans. And this is why when people talk this way, and it's a very widespread view in the scientific community throughout the world, it's called the Anthropocene, right? Which is this new geological era, right? That originated, let's say, with the Industrial Revolution, late 18th century, when suddenly you start to get this radical transformation of the environment, right, where you start putting factories up where farms used to be, you start having a massive increase in population, you start having science and technology basically reshaping the environment in which human beings live, and to a large extent reshaping the human beings themselves so that their life expectancies double or triple in some cases. And as a result, we end up having 6 or 7 times more people now than we did back then. And they're all active, they're all doing shit, okay? And it's the Anthropocene. Okay? Now, if you look at the world, if you look at things from that perspective, from that kind of radical ecological perspective, human beings, having too many of them at least, looks like a big problem. And that there's a sense in which the problem is actually in what the humans are doing. Right? So in terms of the value added of being human, there is an argument being put forward, at least implicitly, that it's negative. That we need fewer humans, or we need fewer beings acting like humans. Right? That is part of what the argument is here. So the business of... I'm kind of presenting in a kind of interesting contrast here, right? Because on the one hand, as I said in the beginning, there's a sense in which what it is to be human is defined by whatever escapes the technology, right? Whatever the technology cannot capture, whatever automation cannot capture, all of that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, I'm saying, as a result of that, as a result of humans being able to exist in this way, independent of technology, right, and being able to have their own lives and being able to use technology and so forth, we end up having too many humans who are causing too much trouble to the planet. So there's a question, an open question, I would say, in the times in which we live, about what exactly is the value added of being human, and is that value positive or negative? Okay? And I will leave it there and maybe take a couple of questions.
Yes, sir.
We'll just wait to get the microphones up. That'll be easier for everybody to hear what you have to say.
Okay.
Who did you want to take?
This guy, he was right off the starting gate here.
I just have a quick question about the replacement of specialized labor.
Yeah.
From my take on what you were saying is that the more specialized someone becomes in a particular field or area, the easier it is to root that content or that expertise into digital and computer, computer knowledge, and computer.
This is already being. This is one of the main early areas of artificial intelligence research. Was that actually?
So I just wondered if you could give us maybe one or two examples.
Sure.
Exactly how one turns expertise, an area of expertise, into a sort of an algorithm or an autonomous.
Okay. No. I'm glad you asked that question because this is actually. You might say this is the part of artificial intelligence research that's easy. Okay? Because when you have a specialized area, a field, one of the implications is that there are certain rules by which you deal with things. Because the area is very well defined, and that's when we say something is technical, we mean that in fact you have to already know a lot in order to be able to operate in it, and so the question is what it is you need to know. So any kind of expertise that requires a lot of explicit education, for example, right, where there are textbooks which you have to learn and master. And this is where law school, I keep on mentioning law school and medical school, you think about the way in which teaching occurs in a lot of these cases, right? Where there's a lot of, you know, textbook-based learning, right? That is easy for a computer to do, right? And already in the 1980s, there were a lot of, one of the ways in which you might say illicit expertise from humans to put into machines was through interviews. All right, you'd get like a kind of person who's an expert in a particular branch of medicine or an expert in a particular branch of law, and you basically interview them to get a sense of how they make decisions about particular cases that they routinely run across, right? And you ask them a question. Suppose you have a patient like this. Suppose you have a patient like that. Suppose you have a client like this. Suppose you have a client like that. What do you do? And then you keep on asking questions, and what you end up developing essentially are decision trees, right? Where in a sense, if in this situation do this, if in that situation do that, and because the whole thing is so specialized, the expert already kind of knows in advance all the different types of possibilities that are likely to arise. That's what makes them expert, right? They can see a situation and know exactly what to do because they recognize it. And see, that's easy to program in a computer. Okay? And most of our professional training and most of the stuff that we pay professionals a lot of money to do throughout their careers is exactly of that kind. It really is, right? Anything that you can study through textbooks and examinations and be qualified on that basis is something a computer could do, right? Because it's fundamentally not creative, right? But it's when we talk, see, creative is to somehow break out of the box. Now, of course, in both law and medicine and other professions, there are creative problems, right? Where in a sense you cannot reduce the knowledge that's needed to just what you were taught in the textbooks. And then you go beyond that. And that escapes artificial intelligence. You see what I mean? That escapes artificial intelligence. But what doesn't escape artificial intelligence is the normal stuff. Because that you can easily codify, and you can just interview experts to tell you.
Okay.
This guy here. I see there are a couple of, I see you behind him as well. It's just, the lights have been glaring. We'll get to you.
Thank you very much for that talk. So I have a question about UBI and the idea of paying people to live.
Yeah, paying people to live, yeah.
That have had concerns with humanity, have looked at the way that work has been a central part of how we define ourselves as humans. And if
right.
we take that away, then what are we?
Yes.
So you mentioned that when it first came up in the 70s, it was seen as a way of sort of actually boosting civil society, removing pressures from other areas of specialized work, which are going to lose, we're going to lose anyway. So are they being paid to live, or actually, is it rather than a private company paying a private individual to do a specialized job, actually the state is paying people to
do a paying people to engage in politics and a specialized activity.
They're not being paid to live, they're actually being paid to do a healthier kind of work. I'm not pro or anti.
I think in terms of the you might say, the neoliberal imaginary in which we live, this is a way of looking at it. Yes, he definitely, because this guy Gores, right, who's a kind of anarcho-Marxist guy, actually was worried that people weren't getting involved in politics, and he thought this is the way to get them into politics, right? And you'd make, and I guess to go to your question, the heart of your question is, he would make that a condition of getting the basic income. In other words, you would have to participate, right? Okay, so I think that's kind of what you're getting at, right? And so in that sense, it would be like paid. So he connected those two things very directly together. It would be like a kind of citizen's income. And sometimes you may have heard that expression, citizen's income. Well, this is what it's meant, right? Where you have an obligation to participate in political life if you get this money. Yeah, that's the spirit in which he was operating. But that's removed from the contemporary discussion. This is my point.
Why?
That's a good question. No, I think it speaks. It speaks to the relatively, depoliticized or somewhat cynical attitude toward politics as something that you ought to be spending your time on. I mean, at least in the sense that Gores was, because Gores was kind of still imagining politics in the classical sense of people, you know, in a council chamber arguing about what should we do with our wealth, where should we spend, you know, like a bigger Congress or a bigger parliament. That's kind of what he was imagining, right? And I think people have grown quite skeptical of that kind of conception of politics. But there is no other conception of politics that replaced it. This is the problem. Right? All there is kind of political sniping of a sort, which you often see in the protest movements that take place, which have kind of impact for, you know, very sharp impact or for very limited periods of time and never get institutionalized. This woman back here had, I've been blinded by glare, so if you're waving your hands, put them very high. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm not exactly sure it's a question as much as a commentary.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I think the use of law as an excuse, as an example, it's flawed on its foundational basis, because I'm a lawyer, I specialize in human rights and development, and I've never met any two cases that are the same, regardless of what
this
thoughts. But and that is the most...
That's the most extreme thing.
No, even with the most fundamental area of law, property law, I have never met two properties that are the same. I draw up agreements that are supposed to be basic, that any regular law student is supposed to be able to do, and I've never met any two that are the same. Every area of law, I think, regardless of how foundational it is, is requires critical thinking, which cannot be executed by a computer as of yet. Of course, there are things we thought were impossible 10 years ago, and today they are possible. But as of now, we're simply unable to do that. And I'm, of course, you're an expert, and I know you're going to counter everything I just said. But
I'm just saying, okay,
I think it's a flawed foundational basis, because up to now, what you're taught in school is simply where to find the law, not how to think critically, not what the law is, because the law changes every day, literally every day. Donald Trump just issued a Trump ban that has changed the case of immigration, and every day these decisions are made. And even with the most rudimentary areas of law, once a decision is taken in any court any day, a computer can't critically analyze that.
Okay, look, here's the thing. At one level, I agree with you, but there is another level at which this ends up mattering. So first of all, let me just concede what I think is true, is that when we're talking about areas of the law that are inherently controversial, you might say, and I would put human rights legislation right on the top of that, frankly, right, where in a sense there is nothing very normal about dealing with it. Those are always kind of critical cases. I don't see a computer replacing that. So you're safe with the job, okay? So let's get that off the table. However, when we look at other more routinized areas of the law, and this applies to medicine too, I think while you're correct that the way a lawyer would do it, and the way a lawyer would see a particular case, is not like the way a computer would process it, I think at the end of the day, what's going to drive the argument is the client. In other words, does the client think that it's better to have a human lawyer who charges through the nose for a routine service, or going through some kind of, artificial intelligence program that might be a lot cheaper and do it much more quickly, even if that program doesn't do it with the kind of nuance and sophistication and all the rest of it that you'd be able to do it. So there's a sense in which this is capitalism all over again, right? This is the same old capitalism. Namely, are the clients, the people who are at the receiving end, who's going to employ your services, do they think that having a human being makes that big a difference, even granting that there is a difference? Right? So let's grant that there's a difference. Does the difference matter? And that's where, and in the professional fields, right, at the end of the day, the client is king. Right? The client rules. And if the client is willing to take an artificial intelligence program that settles their divorce, settles their property sales, whatever, right, that'll fly. I mean, I'll give you an example. There's this guy, Susskind. I don't know if you know about him. Just look him up. I think it's David Susskind. I forget the name of the first name. But he writes a lot on the technological unemployment of lawyers in this country. Okay. I was at a debate at Imperial College a year and a half ago, which was sponsored by the law society in this country, and it was a debate. And the debate was, do you expect that in 25 years' time, most of the sort of activities that lawyers currently do will be replaced? And the audience was primarily lawyers, right? Legally oriented. 60-40, it won. 60-40, that they believed that most of the routine jobs would be replaced in 25 years, okay? And if you see there is a good market already existing for these artificial intelligence programs, or very simplified ones that can do the wills for you and divorce settlements and things like that. There's already a market for that out there, and those things aren't even very sophisticated. So imagine what happens as the artificial intelligence research increases in these areas. So I think at the end of the day, if lawyers want to stay in business, they're going to have to make an argument for why it matters that they do it differently from the machine. I think that's where the argument's going to end up landing. That's what I would say. But you should look this guy up, Susskind. I'm not making this stuff up. Trust me.
We'll do one more question.
Sure.
Okay.
Actually, I'm sorry. See, it's very hard to see you guys.
You're saying that as humans become more unemployable in the future, that the only way is to shift from capitalism to socialism?
I think it's an open question, because nobody seems to believe in socialism, and the question is, what are we socializing exactly, right? I mean, I think if you have a view, see, this is where the whole business that André Gorz was talking about was so important, because André Gorz, like Karl Marx, operated on the assumption that there was some kind of shared sense of the social, a kind of common social interest that everybody would be equally interested in participating in and contributing to. And that would determine how the wealth in the society was spent and distributed and so forth. Okay? You might want to call that socialism, okay? Fine. It's not clear to me that that kind of vision exists anymore. That's my point, because I think one of the things that's happened as the computer revolution has gotten into our minds is that it has, in a sense, privatized us more, right? People get into these very individualized kind of spaces, right, where they just interact with certain kinds of other people and so forth, and there's no longer this kind of overarching common sense of the collective, right? And when that happens, then it becomes very difficult to talk about politics or even society in any kind of robust sense. That's what I would say. So it's a kind of an open question what's on the other side of this, okay? But it's not obvious socialism's on the other side of it. That's my point. It may have been in the 1970s when Gores was talking about this, but I don't think it's so clear now. Yes?
Hi, thank you for this. So I've got a question really about the human interaction. I work for a human rights law center. And we have a lot of clients coming to us, and I would say we spend half the time discussing, you know, the legal thing, but what the other half is taken up by them sharing their life experience. And I know a lot of elderly people, when they go to the doctors, they actually go more to talk to them.
Sure.
And what about this, you know, human interaction?
I mean, the medical profession, of course, has been trying to address this in the reform of education for actually throughout my entire career. They've been trying to do it. It's not just happening now. It's been happening for at least 30 years. But this might matter. My point is, at the end of the day, it's going to depend on what the client wants. Right, because, let me put it brutally, as far as, let's say, the patient is concerned, in your example of the patient. A patient may like to spend a lot of time talking to a doctor about his or her ailments and so forth, and feels very comforted by that. The question is going to be, if they've got a choice between paying a lot of money to do that with a human being versus being able to just being dealt with by an artificial intelligence program in terms of symptoms and whatever in a very straightforward way for less amount of money, which will they choose? This is and you should not presume the answer to this. This is my point. You should not presume the answer to this. And also, if we're talking about a national healthcare system that's going to be with a tight budget, okay? Right, in terms of what is minimal standard of healthcare, we may get to a point where actually having a human GP is not part of the minimal. That in fact, as long as you have access of some sort, including to an artificial intelligence program that is able to accurately diagnose and treat your symptoms, that might be sufficient. Right, we may end up because of financial reasons. So the point here is, I take your point, there is a difference. The question is that in the long term, how much is that difference going to matter? That's what I'm saying.
I know some of you guys might have more questions. We're going to go straight into the panel, so you can save it for that time. I'd like to welcome Amber and Adam, who are going to talk to us about what they think the future of work is going to look like. So if you guys are okay to come on to the stage now. We'll have Lily, who will be chairing some of the debate tomorrow, chair this discussion. She's going to make sure that the comments are kept crisp and short, and that the questions are answered. I'll cover with you what you guys want to hear about.
And the water is easy, so there we go. So, I have something to copy it off. I just want to make sure you can hear it.
Do you want that page up?
Let me copy it now.
Yeah, you want to do that?
Yeah, but before you, yeah. Because I've got a, where is the, here?